You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome once again to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And today we're talking about episode 205 of HBO's The Deuce series, entitled All You'll Be Eating Is Cannibals. Fine young cannibals. The most delicious type. Jim, what do you think of this episode?
It's another solid one. I don't think I'm going to get out of this season without saying... I really enjoyed this episode on every single one, because like I said last week, you know, it feels effortless. It's just a joy to watch most of the time. There are some parts that make me go, oh, no, some bad things are really about to happen, especially as we round the corner to the last half of the season here. You can see the pieces falling into place for like Cece to become extremely violent. Lori got a taste of it. But I would say just a taste of it, you know, because we've seen what happened to Shay. That right. stuff was nasty. And Lori's getting deep in that. I really love the stuff with Frankie. Probably my favorite scene. We'll talk about it at length here in a bit. But my favorite scene was with Frankie and Candy, or Eileen, when she's trying to convince him to essentially manipulate him into giving her money for her movie, which I loved. And then everything that happens after that with the movie and Frankie, I look at it and go, oh no.
Yeah, this is bad.
Candy, you've made such a mistake.
A deal with not a devil, a dumbass devil, maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, those scenes and it's really good.
Yeah, it's funny because a lot of the danger, like I feel like they're setting us up to where a lot of the danger I was looking for might not be there. For example, I was really thinking that this clinic and doctor situation was going to go real bad.
Right.
But
right.
like we saw today, this episode, and I'm like, you know, maybe I was a little too cynical, or these women that are organized this are too smart. Like these aren't like shady back office deals. It's like in a brightly lit, open kind of public area. There's like no place where a doctor could be like, I'll give you this prescription if you suck this dick.
Uh-huh.
Like even, you know, it's like they're not trusting these men to be angels. It's all about transparency and supervision, right?
Yeah.
You know, which is like, I keep on thinking, like, what are the little things that Simon is trying to tell us about his political theory? And I feel like he's accidentally shown, well, I don't know, accident. These women have deliberately engineered a situation that I think David Simon would say is an ideal political situation. One where it's a democratic process. There's very little like power structure. It's set up to not allow corruption. It's set up to be transparent. You know, they're speaking plainly and honestly in public about their, you know, goals, even though maybe they could get advanced a little bit further if they obfuscated. Like I feel like he's making a lot of interesting statements, and also I'm continuing to be fascinated with like the duality that we see this season. Like a lot of these episodes have like equal and opposites. For example, we saw two raids this episode.
Mm-hmm.
One where the cops went in and busted Bobby's joint, and then one where Big Mike and Black Frankie go and bust up some the card game in the Bronx amongst black folk. And you know, I thought it was interesting that my feelings watching both of them was kind of just like bummed. Like,
okay,
here are regular people that are like, everyone's chill. There's no violence. It seems like people are having a good time, and men with guns are coming in and fucking it up. Because they're both illegal enterprises, so there's no recourse to it.
Sure.
I just think it's like that was instructive to me. Like I didn't feel like elated that Big Mike got the big score. I felt like, you know, Big Mike is a fundamentally decent guy who's been corrupted by all this. But I don't know. Yeah. It's really interesting. I'm curious to see, you know, obviously there's a lot of things built coming to a head at the Pimps. There's a lot of things coming ahead with this moral task force, and even Vincent's life looks like it's at a real crossroads.
And they kind of put the mob stuff a little bit on the back burner this time. You know, that Mike score was not part of that. So,
right.
They didn't do much with that, but you got to think that's not over.
No, I mean, I think they're just showing the, like, that was like Abby coming to the realization that she's got this, you've got a righteous view of herself that, like, hey, I've done everything on my own steam and I haven't needed these gangsters. And Vincent's like, well, you know, why do you think you're able to operate in this environment without being, you know, drug into the pity pit? It's because of this protection racket that we're all participating in. And Abby doesn't like that. And, like, you know, like Vincent's, everyone seems like they're being forced to take sides. And Vincent is going to have to decide where he's going to side with his family, or he's going to side with his girlfriend, who I think is got the morally correct course of action and viewpoint here. Mm-hmm. And it's also like you see like the thing with Paul and his boyfriend Ken, like that's kind of tragic. And I think there's like some really interesting duality there between the thing that Paul wants to build for the community versus the parts of the community that Paul seems to be drawn to go to blow off steam. And it's all set up against the AIDS epidemic is coming. So, it's like watching like a ship full of, this is a bad metaphor, and I apologize for it in advance.
I want to hear it more now.
But it's like seeing, like, it's like this is the same kind of, like, if you're an impartial observer seeing a ship full of plague-carrying rats coming into a harbor of a city, and you're like, oh, this is going to be bad. I'm not saying that. Not saying that gay men are vermin. I'm not saying that as an unfortunate. But it's like it's that kind of thing where it's like this is going to decimate a community, and they have no idea. Yeah, yeah. They have no idea. And it's so tragic to see, like, the behind-the-scenes stuff where they talk about how, like, amazing and liberating and free these people felt, and like the grim fucking reaper is going to put, you know, if it wasn't, you know, fucking Gale at the planning board, it's going to be the grim reaper putting his boot to your neck here in a minute. And Jesus, what a bleak, what it feels like season three is going to be pretty fucking bleak.
Mid-80s. They're going to probably jump ahead a few years and we're going to be in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You're right. It looks like a bad omen coming in.
Yeah. So should we get to the episode proper?
Yeah.
Hey, before we get into detailed analysis of the episode, I want to talk about some housekeeping stuff. The Empire Business, a club-only feature for Club Bald Move members, where we take a behind-the-scenes look at what's going on here at Bald Move. We've got the State of the Empire, which is kind of our financial analysis. It's not finance. Podcasting financials are called financials. It's like having a comptroller. No one really knows what it means. It's just that's the term. And then next week we're going to have our studio tour. It's actually our old studio. We just moved out of it. We did a tour of it, the look of it. We went through like all the different things we had in the office, the equipment. It's going to be cool. That's going to be the last of the Empire Business series, and we'll be talking about what we're doing next here in the next few days and next week for sure, the next segment. I think you're going to like it. We're also, of course, covering The Deuce. We got Better Call Saul Season 4 finale happened this week. I can't believe it. It's like I blinked and that season's over. Yeah. We'll be talking about that tomorrow here at baldmove.com. Cecily and I are talking about American Horror Story Season 8 Apocalypse, which has been really fun. It's been super fun to talk about. If you like trashy horror film, campy, funny kind of stuff, it's a good time. Check it out on the American Horror Story podcast feed. Jim and I will be checking out The Bad Times at the Hotel El Royale, I think is the name of this thing.
I don't think hotel's in there, but sure.
Bad Times at the El Royale. It's given me a lot of Dusk Till Dawn vibes.
Sort
of,
yeah.
Yeah, it looks really cool. I hope it's going to be a good one. We'll be talking about that on the Bald Movies feed on Friday. Then we also released on the movie podcast feed, we just talked about Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven this week, released on Monday. Next week, we'll have Oliver Stone's JFK ready for your consumption if those sound interesting to you. All that stuff is on baldmove.com. All right, let's talk about the episode. I wanted to... There's something that I was speaking of duality when I was watching Frankie and Vincent and James Franco. I kind of feel like I got this subtle because you know they're doing with the makeup and hair essentially they're differentiating. But like I was looking at him and I noticed a trick that I think Franco is using where he plays Vincent like Vincent is a mature, responsible, fairly level-headed businessman who plays like he's the cocky playboy. Like, that's his act that he can put on, but it's not like you can see around the edges that that part of the performance is not super convincing. And then when he plays Frankie, it's the exact opposite. Frankie is the cocky moron playboy, and that is who he is, but he can put on the air and the affectation of like the responsible sober businessman, but you can kind of see around the edges of that act.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's like it's so cool to see, you know, that like duality amongst the brothers play out in a single man. I thought that was kind of cool.
And I think it's also interesting, and maybe just a consequence of it being the same person doing both acting jobs.
Right.
But he also manages to maintain, you know, even with the exact opposite personalities, he manages to maintain this feeling that these guys are brothers, you know, and very, like, obviously raised in the same environment. They have a lot of the same experiences. It's something that I think you kind of get for free when you use the same actor for both of those roles.
Sure.
But it does help to sell the effect of them being brothers.
Yeah. And it's just like Frankie is such a case of arrested development. Like, as Eileen was walking up to him and he's bouncing his ball and he's like having his elaborate fantasy of like being a star baseball player or whatever, I'm like, this guy is such a child. Like, what man acts like this? However old he is, what is he, 30 now? And then Eileen walks up and says something like, you know, are you trying out for Little League or what? And I'm like, yes, it's exactly.
And he doesn't get it.
No, because, you know, just like a little boy wouldn't get the fact you're making fun of him if you said something like that. It's
right.
I thought it was kind of interesting.
Let's talk about that scene, because that's maybe my favorite scene. There's absolutely nothing legally binding about a finger through a fence. Let me tell you that first of all.
Right. Yeah. The finger binding can be legal, or can be binding, but through a fence, every judge in the country. There's not a court that you'd have standing with in the country.
It's also profoundly creepy. I don't know why I find this finger through the fence so creepy, but it's like there's something about it. When he jams his finger through that fence, I'm like, oh, that's gross.
Yeah.
Don't touch that finger candy.
It's a bit of a glory hole situation.
Yeah, something like that.
Apparently that was improvised.
Yeah.
That's just something they came up with on the set. And I felt like Maggie Gyllenhaal is so goddamn charming that, like, and maybe it's because that was a genuine, I mean, they're both very good actors.
Yeah.
I'll say that first. But also, like, the fact that, like, if that was improvised and, like, that was the first shot, there was a little bit of something conspiratorial about it. Like, there was, like, some genuine, actual, this is funny kind of thing going on. I thought, yeah, I thought it was great. It was great.
And I think it works in that scene, too, because there is something conspiratorial about what they're doing, right? They're conspiring against the system that essentially is holding Candy back here.
Right.
Which I think is awesome. But also, like, she knows she's just pulled one over on Frankie a little bit. Like, she just wants his money, right? She doesn't want his involvement in the project in any way. And she got it. She got it by playing to his worst instincts, which are the gambling genes that he's got.
Yes.
That idea that this is a gamble and it's safer than most of the gambles you've made. And if you lose it, what's it to you? You know, you've lost this much money many times over.
Yeah.
So who cares?
The old buttonfly gambling genes he's got.
Yeah. No, it's such a good scene. I really love it.
Yeah. And it's like, cause it's both instincts. She plays on the fact he's an inveterate gambler and like explicitly pitches this as a gambling proposition, but also appeals to the fact that he wants to be the big man like his little brother. So she's like, yeah, you can be a swinging dick executive producer and to have all that. And I don't know what's going to end up happening. Like, it seems clear that Vincent is going to get her entangled in a lot of stuff and like fuck up with the salary and like how soon. Like, I don't know how deep it's going to go. Is it going to be just like trying to cast his girlfriend or I guess wife, fiance? Fuck, I don't know. Or is he going to actually start wheeling out, like, metaphorical bags of pennies from the Enterprise, you know?
I mean, he might. We've seen that track record before.
Right.
The other thing he's doing is trying to get other co-producers involved.
Yeah, that's not great.
This is a road to disaster for Eileen, and
I hope
that she sees it, and I hope that she's able to head it off.
Yeah, it could be. I just think it is so clear. I mean, I think these are her, like, these are her hustler. That's what the word I want to use. These are her hustler instincts kicking in, because she, not only did she know exactly what she needed to say to get this guy hot and bothered for the proposition, mm-hmm. but she also, like, super smart and, like, velvet glove the whole, do you got it on you? Because she knows, like, this pinky through the fence thing is bullshit. Yeah. And if she leaves Frankie for 24 hours, he's going to go spend $10,000 on anchovy pizza to make up with his girlfriend, you know?
Yeah.
She's real clever. But I also, so if we want to just keep talking about Eileen, like, mm-hmm. there's a lot of duality in her role too, because on the one hand, I think she's got the makings of a really talented filmmaker, because she really is getting in psychologically, like, what are people wanting to see and why? What is the core fantasy here? What is, and is there a fantasy that we can reach out and, like, I mean, the best way to build a new market, like, if she wants to do female empowerment film and, like, some more cerebral, more erotic things, the best way to build a market that doesn't exist is to find a way to appeal to the existing market and also attract those other people into that. And I feel like that she's doing that. She's going to have solid fucking and sucking, but she's also got this, you know, that's the other thing is, I thought there would be trouble not using Harvey's wife for the writer, but mm-hmm. we found out that she actually paid a guy to write, and he wrote a conventional kind of, like, man, you know, this is Little Red Riding Hood story, but it's the big bad wolf who's the star.
Yeah.
And she just instinctually knows that's not right.
Right. She couldn't get that perspective out of him.
Right. So she's going to have Harvey's wife write the erotic version of Taxi Driver.
Uh-huh.
For free. For free, too.
Yeah.
But so there's the one side. She's smart. She's getting this stuff done. But I also think the fact, like, Harvey's there as, like, a cautionary figure trying to help us understand that she's also very inexperienced and naive on this business side. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to use mob money. I think we're supposed to understand that she's going to eschew filming permits.
Yeah.
And try to do this all kind of, like, guerrilla style. And those are very intensely risky propositions to be doing in New York City, where everyone's got their hand out. And if you don't pay them, then you'll get the other hand that's clenched in a fist. And I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah. And then, you know, the Star Search, I guess, mm-hmm. That they're doing this episode is interesting, especially when it comes to finally meeting with Lori in the apartment, because I look at that scene and I definitely come out on the side of Lori here when she essentially tells Candy, look, you are in a position of privilege. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have a CC, and you never had a CC mm-hmm. on your back. And that's the thing that I think, you know, Eileen at the beginning of that scene doesn't understand as well as Eileen at the end of that scene, right? Where mm-hmm. She has had the opportunity to go her own way and create her own destiny because she didn't have this big monkey on her back. So mm-hmm. what the fuck is Lori to do at this point? And I think Candy at the end of that scene finally understands a little bit more about that, even though I think at the beginning of the scene she should have. She knew what that life was like, and that's why she avoided it for so long, and yet she sort of let herself believe that she had created her own destiny against all odds, but she wasn't against all odds, right? She was against a lot of the odds, mm-hmm. but not all of them. Mm-hmm. Lori is up against all the odds.
That I like that take. It's different from the one I had, which is I thought Eileen was humoring Lori here a lot because, you know, Lori's angry and Lori's vulnerable. The fact is, I think Eileen, if she didn't need anything from Lori, just wanted to blow Lori's spot, she could be like, you're right, Lori, I didn't have a man, and I preemptively took a lot of beatings too, because she got the shit beat out of her, like, worse than I've seen any of the other girls on the show, just mm-hmm. from a random John because she didn't have a pimp's protection. And, like, how many times has that happened to her over there? So it's not like Candy just, you know, when Eileen was out there as Candy just floating among the clouds and dodging raindrops. Like, she took, like, and that's what Lori's like. She doesn't want to take that. She mm-hmm. got to take, she does, that's, like, I don't know. Do you think this is the first time Cece beat Lori? I almost feel like it is, because it wasn't like it was like just a, you know, what, a quick a couple backs of the hands.
Yeah.
And I like in contrast to like last year, Dorothy, or I forget her, Ashley, her street name, you know, I felt like that's, you know, like when he starts cutting on you, that's when he's, you know, he's beat on you a couple times. And you know, we had talked about the difference to Lori is that, like, she kind of came pre-broken. Like, she's like, yep, I know what the game plan is. I'm on board the game plan. I am fully supportive of the game plan. You don't need to worry about me, Cece.
Yeah.
But, you know, Candy is essentially saying the type of beating or the type of danger that you're afraid of to get by leaving CC is the type of beatings that I just risked and received because I didn't want a CC in my life. So, but I think it's the right call. That's why I think Eileen's smart, because if she said that to Lori, then Lori goes and, you know, runs off. You know, she loses her as a friend and an ally.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. It was good. And then turn it in. Do you think the other thing is, like, did Eileen plan? I wonder how much of this was Eileen also pushing her buttons to get this performance out of her just as an experiment.
Yeah, that's kind of a gross part of the scene to me. Like,
yep.
When it turns from this very intimate, personal, I don't know, confession is not the right word. This spilling of her guts, right, to Eileen. It turns into an audition at that point, and I felt very grossed out by that.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're supposed to, because, you know, that's the way, again, the duality of this, where you start off with one thing and you end up seeing getting the other. Mm. I totally agree. I also, in the opening, the cold open, where, you know, Kiki, or Cece's talking about Kiki to Lori, at what point did you know Lori was in danger? Because
it was the moment where their stories started to line up. When Lori says, oh, yeah, it'll be just like the times when you weren't there when I was, you know, doing the Johns or whatever. That's when I knew. I was like, oh, shit, that they both have the same story here. Cece's going to put this together.
Yeah, it's funny because I kept on going back and forth the second time I watched it. I was like, because the part of me says that, like, I think CC is just street smart enough to know that he can, you know, he's such a hustler that he can smell a hustle. And, you know, Lori was trying to do this, like, very affected disinterest of, like, oh, wow, you talked to her. Oh, CC, what's her name? You know, or Kiki, what's her name?
And yeah.
Then when you're right, when she put the, like, because you know Kiki probably said the same thing. Come on, CC, relax. It's like, you weren't in the room holding the John's dick, were you? And when Lori came back that, like, I think he was just kind of prodding until he found the confirmation. But the whole scene, I'm just, like, holding my breath because, like, CeCe's a smart guy, really good at reading people. And Lori, maybe she's good at manipulating people, but, like, you're never as good when you're afraid. It's like, you know, it's like when you're playing poker and the stakes are high, that's when you're most likely to tell. And she was telling all over the place. And what did you think the point was, the scene, the quote unquote makeup scene that didn't really work, where Cece gets her a puppy and a big ass box of chocolates and wants everything to be all better?
I mean, the only thing I can take from that is that Cece doesn't understand what makes Lori tick, and why would he? Why would he care? You know, as long as she's under his thumb, who cares?
Right.
And so when he goes and he tries to get these chocolates and booze and a puppy, she like is kind of like, ah, oh, this is cool, but not even close to the thing that I actually want, which is something of my own. And this puppy is not my own. You got it for me. That's like.
Yeah.
You know, Lori's looking for something outside of CC's realm, and that's just not going to happen. And it's nothing he can give her, right?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, yeah, you're right.
Without losing his control, anyway.
Exactly. It ties back into that monologue she had with the audition monologue, it turns out, where she's like, you know, everything that I have and everything that I am is something that he owns.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, and now he's essentially giving... I thought that was telling, too, that he's like, what, you like dogs? And she's like... I mean, that's because, like, 90% of the human population likes dogs and would have a little stronger reaction. But she's like, I don't know, I got the impression that, like, maybe she isn't even that thrilled about dogs. Maybe she thinks they stink or whatever. And she just was like, you know, I don't know, whatever. But now it's like he's got Cece's gotten her a chore, essentially.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm trying to figure out, like, I also, because I'm also shocked, like, you know, we open up with Cece giving her a beating, and then this scene, like, I thought Lori, I'm not saying it's wrong for her to be angry and to, but, like, I thought it was foolhardy almost to refresh on that, to, like, be pretty strong with Cece and, like, you know, tell you know, like be pretty defiant about these presents and stuff. I don't know, and that's the thing, is like I felt like Cece was doing that math too, like, damn, I just beat this woman and now I've got her, so I'm doing the standard like makeup thing and she ain't having it. Like,
well, I mean, none of Cece's tricks are working, right? Like, look what happens with Dorothy. That yeah. doesn't work, I don't think.
It doesn't work, but I don't know, like, what is victory for these people? When I was watching that scene the second time, I'm like, so if Cece flies off half-cocked and kills Dorothy, and he goes to jail for it, did Dorothy win? Like, you know, if Dorothy doesn't provoke Cece and Dorothy succeeds in unionizing the street workers and brokering peace between the streets and the pimps and the cops, like, does Cece lose? It's a really weird game theory, right? Because they're all you know, and there's the concept of justice is kind of like out the window here. I kept on thinking, like, you know, what does everyone want here, and what's likely to happen? Because I just, every single time that, you know, Dorothy gets put into the same room or in the same street as Cece, I get scared, because, you know, he's already dealing with rebellions from his, you know, from his main woman, and now his other main woman that left him and humiliated him is, you know, rubbing it in his face. Like, that's, I mean, Dorothy's just courageous. She's completely courageous, and I hope it doesn't get her killed. But I've seen a lot of David Simon stuff, and that tends to happen.
I'm actually more worried about Lori because of what's happening with Dorothy. Like, that's the thing that scares me, is that Dorothy's going to provoke Cece into taking his frustration and anger out on the person he does still have control over, which is Lori.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
every time Dorothy gets in his face, I'm like, oh, no, Lori. Oh, no.
That's a good take, because I always, yeah, the fact that, like, Dorothy's kind of out of his orbit, and that actually might intimidate him, because he doesn't know what kind of pull she's got and what she's doing and what she's trying to accomplish. But, you know, he still has Lori under his thumb, so why not just double down on keeping what he's got?
Right.
But I don't know. I just thought that's, like, I did like that scene, because I felt like Cece got increasingly desperate in his, like, because that's all he's got. Like, I essentially you were in my cult. But, you know, when someone leaves a cult, like, getting them back, you know, if they're in a phase like Dorothy's in, where she's, like, completely been deprogrammed and has got her own connections and her own support systems, like, getting someone just be, you know, like, Cece seemed delusional.
Yeah.
And Dorothy was in control. And I liked when he, like, tried to get into her physical space and she took, like, a half step back, because she is intimidated by this man. But then she just, like, planted her feet and took that half step back, like, immediately. Like, no, I'm not going to happen this. If you're going to kill me right here in front of all these fucking witnesses, and at least you'll, you know, rot in Rikers or whatever.
Yeah.
Super brave. I hope it doesn't blow up in her face.
Can I talk about Shay real quick?
Let's talk about Shay.
And I think her name's Fran, the woman who runs the peep show booths.
Oh, no, it's Irene.
Oh, God. That's confusing. too many I-E-ns in
totally,
this show.
totally.
Okay. So... Irene, this turned from something that I thought was awesome into something that felt abusive and exploitative, like, at the drop of a hat here. Like, as soon as they get back to, I guess, Irene's apartment, it immediately turned sexual. And I was like, oh, my God, if this is such a bad situation for Shay. She's now unable to go back to her old life without the fear of getting hooked on it again and overdosing on heroin or whatever, where the hell she was on. She's stuck in this apartment now with this woman who is making sexual advances. If she's not interested here, this is very, very bad. And I think it's interesting because I think it would be more obvious and more scary if this was a man doing this to Shay. You know, she's tired of dicks, but okay, maybe you throw some tits in the mix and she's up for it now. I just, that's another scene that I felt a little bit skeeved out by.
Well, I think your instincts are good because, like, you know, that's, I mean, I think that if you got, let's say, because, you know, as a straight white man, we rightfully so get a lot of shit about, like, our behavior and the fact that we've been on top of the world for a long time now, and we haven't exactly covered ourselves in glory with our run. But I think there is a school of thought that, like, if you could just, like, you know, slap the sense into all the straight white guys in the world, that the world would be a better place. And that's probably true. But there are, you know, straight white men are humans, and humans tend to exploit other people. And that's the tale. It just, you could, I mean, I thought it was explicit that, like, Shay is being helped by this fellow woman, and there was that dynamic. And then Irene, like, literally as soon as she got Shay to accept this offer and, like, make it bare that, like, it's this or going back to Rodney, which is going to be beatings and addiction and probably death, she cloaks it with, like, oh, is it okay? Oh, no. But, like, she just, it's super inappropriate to pivot the relationship to that in these circumstances.
Yeah, she got her just clean enough to understand the danger she was in if she went back to it.
Totally predatory.
Yeah, and then took advantage of it.
And you could see, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
I was going to say, this is no different than the doctor who asks for a blowjob in order to get pills, right?
Right. And, like, you can see that on Shay's face. Like, she kind of blinks and is like, oh, I get it. You're my pimp now. Okay. So right. I'll minimize. Like, but you can tell, like, this isn't something, I don't know. Maybe I don't want to editorialize too far in the other direction. It was like Shay would not contemplate a lesbian relationship, but, like, she never has. And I don't what does consent actually even mean in this scenario where it's very clear that the person has no other option? Like, this is why, like, sexual harassment became a thing in the last three decades, because if someone is dependent upon you for their livelihood or their career or their shelter or their safety, like, what is consent in that situation? Like, well, yeah, you can tell me no, but then your life will turn into a nightmare shithole.
Right. It's that power imbalance. Yeah.
Yeah, but then Irene is also trying to talk her up or prop her up. But it's like, I guess if I had to choose, like, she's a clear upgrade over Rodney.
For sure.
But Shay is still in, like, this kind of, like, I'm trading sex for security. That's the straight up exchange. And, like, I don't, like, she hasn't escaped in the same way that Dorothy's escaped. And maybe that's going to be the thing, like, that this will be a stepping stone she can get with Dorothy, and, like, maybe she can truly get free. The other thing is, you know, I've been pretty tough on Irene. I don't think she's an evil person. I don't think a lot of people are evil. They just don't know any better. And, you know, I also think the story here is that she's had feelings for Shay for a long time. And now she's just, like, you know, desperate to act on them. She's playing a dangerous game with Rodney.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, like, I think if Rodney wasn't, like, fucking sky high all the time, he would already kind of seen through this act. And because I don't think he quite cottons on to the fact that Irene has essentially lifted Shay right out from underneath his nose. But that will, like, you know, New York, for such a big city, it's incredibly small place, it seems like, in this show. Because it's not like they're, like, moving to a different borough or whatever. Like, it's they're in the same area. This is going to be found out, and then what happens? But I don't know, because that's the thing. Like, I could see in a world, you know, Irene's got mob protection. If Rodney comes and beats the piss out of her, I don't know. Like, that we might have another dead pimp on our hands at the other, and it won't have to be.
There you go.
Yeah. It won't have to be Slim Charles lowering the boom this time.
No, maybe they'll send him in. He seems to be the executor.
What else do we want to talk about? I thought it was a very clever. I want to talk about we can talk about Darlene and Larry and that whole situation, and then I want to talk about Big Mike, because there's just a really funny transition there. So I thought it was really, Larry continues to be charming, like, trying to, like, study his art. Like, he's watching this movie, I think it's called Blue Collar. It's got Harvey Keitel and Richard Pryor's in it. And he's like going down, he's watching this and like just seeing the, you know, this acting job. And then he's walking down and he's like practicing his lines. And then he tries to like make it his own by he's like, you know, got to stay on the line, Jack. And he's like, nah, he wouldn't say that. I think that's really funny. And it's like the, you know, one of the amusing things in the episode. But then you see that it's having his being Twitter-pated with the whole acting career is having him slip in his pimping duties, which is keeping the women he's with from being beat by the men that they're servicing. And there's, you know, he's talking about having trouble making his nut, the fact that they're, you know, got family depending on him. A lot of that's because, like, Larry is lost a couple steps. He doesn't have his head in the game.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you say lost a couple steps, I think he's moving in the right direction is the weird thing. Like, what he needs to do here, in my opinion, is jettison some of the people who are keeping his nut up so high. Maybe, you know, let other pimps take them, bring them to Abby, let her, you know, get these people back up on their feet.
Right.
Just stick with Darlene, because I think, honestly, Darlene and Larry could have a thing, a good thing going on here, right? They're both into kind of the same stuff. They could both help each other in that regard.
Swinging sexy actors, yeah.
Right. I actually get a pretty good feeling there between Larry and Darlene, but I think Larry is torn right now. Larry's looking for his place in this movie thing, and I don't think until he finds it that he's going to be able to see the path out.
Yeah, and Larry used to be the one that scared me the most because I think Larry is kind of dumb.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, dumb, violent people are the scariest because they're also, especially ones that are insecure the way Larry is, because how the hell do you not insult someone's intelligence? Like, you just never know. Like, you could just be making an offhand remark about a fact that you know that they didn't, and then you're getting beat up because you made them feel stupid. Like, it's a it's a literally fucking landmine. But, like, it's weird how mellowed out he is, which makes me think that, like, it's going to hide something bad. But I don't know.
Okay. And
it's also, like, because I while you're talking, I'm thinking, like, you know, what if Larry just came home like a zookeeper at the zoo and just threw his cages open and be like, all right, go on, women, go forth and sin no more. Like, I imagine a lot of the women would be like, no, fuck that. You need to take care of us. Like,
yeah.
True justice isn't like when you've got an exploiter and an exploitee and the exploiter just stops. Like, the true justice is helping the exploitee back onto their feet and to reintegrate society, because just stopping it and turning it loose is literally like just shutting down a zoo and open up its cages and being like, the animals fend for yourself. Like, how the fuck would they do that?
No, this is the thing that Dorothy was talking about, you know, when they're discussing how to handle this problem of the pimps and the prostitution, and she says we need to support the women. That's what she means, right?
Yes.
Like, you can't just shut off the floodgates and hope that everyone will be okay. And that's why I say, like, Larry needs to maybe take these women to someone like Abby, someone who can show them the right path forward, help them get the things that they need, and figure out a new position in life for themselves.
Right. But you see that Simon's making a point that that's the official plan of the New York City Police Department and the Task Force of Moral is to shut down the zoo and open up the cages.
Yeah. And it's a stupid one.
if it wasn't for Abby and Dorothy and those types, like, that should be a two-step plan. You should close the zoo, open the cages, and then have trained veterinarians and animal placement services coming in there to help them, you know, get reintegrated back to life. But, like, it's just, you know, that's the thing about, like, you know, politics and the moral politics especially, is it does seem like it's very short-sighted and myopic because, you know, you go down, you shut down a massage parlor. What are those girls going to do? Like, go get secretary jobs next tomorrow? With criminal records because they're hauling them. It's just, I don't know. It's depressing.
No, that's a part of the, you know, the ideals of serve and protect. The serve part is something I think we need a little bit more of because, in my opinion, what needs to happen here is the cops need to go work with Abby, work with Dorothy, work with the people who are trying to do the good in the community.
Yeah.
Get that structure in place before they just shut everything down.
This shouldn't be a grassroots thing. This should have, like, official money and a legal policy and behind it. And the fact that, like, it's a damn good thing that this organization effort was happening behind the scenes, because it's probably going to blunt some of the damage. But I don't know. Like, my
but it's accidental, right? It's a complete fluke that it happened at the same time.
My nightmare scenario is you're going to see this moral task force start cracking down on these clinics, just like their massage parlors. We already saw a hint of that, where we know the woman renting the van got picked up for prostitution charges.
Right.
Like, I think the nightmare scenario is they're going to destroy both programs. The illegitimate pimp, flesh trade, and the actually trying to support and help those women, and it's just going to be a fucking shit show.
We'll see.
But yeah, the other thing is, what is going on with Darlene? Because Darlene's got she's educating herself.
Mm-hmm.
She has a man who seems to be courting her a bit, and it's also she's starting to chafe at having to be like this glamorous, porno movie star, and also still turning tricks at the same time. I wonder, because what you said before sounds nice about them, like, doing this life together, but, like, I don't feel like that's where the story is precisely going.
No? Huh.
Yeah, I think Darlene, eventually has gotta not even want to do the porno stuff. She's going to want to get a job. She's wanting to settle down with this gentleman from Wakanda, and maybe that'll be it. Like, you'll find out this guy's actually the dad of Black Panther, and like, Larry's going to step to him, and he's just going to go badly for him.
Sure,
going to get his vibranium ass whipping, Larry. Don't touch Darlene. You're going to get in trouble. But I love the transition between that man saying "Say no more. I never pressure a lady" to like Big Mike pressuring a lady, and getting the hot tip about the family card game. What a trip for Big Mike. Like, he was like the man of the hour, lording over Club 366, and now he's he's not a henchman. He's like an Omar.
Running a crew.
I guess.
He's like Nick Cage in Gone in 60 Seconds.
There you go.
He's running a crew.
I was gonna go with Omar, but yeah, let's right. Go, because he's got a little bit of he's not exactly the other thing we found out about Big Mike is he's not exactly straight down the stereotypical masculine line when it comes to his sexual proclivities.
Sure.
But I don't know. It's interesting to see, like, there's a little bit of commentary about there's this like black on black crime, because there's this mm-hmm. this family, there's like this neighborhood card party, ain't nobody getting hurt by anybody, and these guys get a word of it and they go and fuck it up. How many times can they do that? Like, right now, and I think that's the story, is like these card games are being guarded by a big dude with a machete. Well, that ain't gonna last for very long. Nobody's going to play cards if the big man at the doors has got a machete. So now there's going to be guns. There's going to be like this violence begets violence. And for the first time, I've started worrying about I thought Big Mike was just going to be the guy who busts heads and throws drunks out. I think he might be going into harm's way in mm-hmm. a big way now.
Yeah, he could be, especially once Frankie gets involved. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing that honestly worries me the most about this for some reason is...
Right.
Cutting Frankie into that,
right?
Because Frankie can be a bit of a loose cannon, far more so than Big Mike or Black Frankie.
But I don't think Big Mike's going to take Frankie on. Like, I got that he was humoring this guy. Like,
okay,
especially when he's like, "Hey, I'll take my brother's cut," and like Black Frankie just kind of gives him a look. He's like, "Okay, never mind." Like, he's going to intimidate those guys. And the only way he would have in is if, like, he went to Rudy and said, "I want you to force me into Big Mike's crew." And I think Rudy would tell him to go fuck himself. So, there is another interesting kind of, like, a subplot to this, which is where Tommy was impressed by this heist and the score. Mm-hmm. And then he asked about Carlos, and Mike's like, "No, this guy's a drunk." Tommy had a look that might say that, Carlos is going to be sleeping with the fishes. Because we saw him falling asleep in the big boss's car when he's trying to be, he's like, I think Tommy might take care of this guy. There was a very dark look crossing his face when he found out that he shit the bed with Big Mike here.
Yeah.
So
could be. I wouldn't put it past that guy to kill some people.
Right. Also, trademark David Simon black humor when, you know, Big Mike's like, can you not count? I said two hands on the table. And the guy like sheepishly pulls out his hook.
Yeah.
And then Big Mike and Frankie look at each other and it's like, what? You know, that's, yeah, it's good. Good.
It is. One of the things that I want to talk about is Paul and his situation.
That's
kind of just danced around it a little bit. But so in this episode, you know, he goes to the zoning board, I think is where he's meeting here. In a what do they call it? Town meeting, I suppose.
Some kind of city council, alderman, something like that.
Trying to get the zoning for his lounge, let's call it. Definitely not a bar.
Not a bar.
Trying to get that approved.
And a lounge.
It goes strangely, in my opinion. I did watch the after credits sequence, and they were talking, David Simon particularly was talking about what a vibrant, exciting time this was for the gay community.
Sure.
In New York. And I guess I didn't have that impression of the late 70s. I thought it was something that was still much more under the table, but this town council member or this zoning board guy just comes out and says, hey, I'm gay. The person sitting next to me is gay. We don't have any problems with that. And nobody in the room, it's tough, right? Everybody is kind of couching their stuff in terms of like, oh, well, it's going to be noisy. I'm not objecting to the type of people, just the noise and stuff.
Right.
But it was very above the table, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah, I wonder, because, you know, it would be extremely interesting to see what happened to the plight of gay people in America had the AIDS epidemic not happened.
Right.
Because I wasn't alive. I mean, I was alive for this, but I was like 2 years old. So I think the story he's telling here is like, you know, gay, like, imagine, like, you know, if you're a straight person, imagine if you weren't allowed to, like, be sexual or have sex or even proposition the people that you're sexually attracted to your entire life. Everything had to be furtive and underground. And imagine, like, for the first time that this started opening up and there's, like, clubs of like-minded people that you could just go and get your bone on, or you can, and now they're like wanting, like, well, that's great, but like also we want to just hang out and talk and like live like people. And there's this guy who's like, you know, like he's older than Paul and he's been doing this for a lot longer, and he's just being like, you know what, I'm not gonna let this young man get blackhearted by you people. This isn't just about like, we're not just all about sucking and fucking and run around shirtless with assless chaps and like scandalized. I think the undercurrent is like, that's how you know us, because that's all you've allowed us to be. Like, we'll take whatever you allow us, but now we want actually a place in civic life. And I do remember the AIDS scare and how it was like, you know, like, well, this is God's scourge. And I feel like that emotional shit really, like, people are on the fence, like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Or like, hey, if you hug these people or bring them close into your life, you might be able to catch it. And it's just
right.
And it also, like, you know, we talk about in the Black Klansman podcast, how like every time you know, black leadership would step forward, they get assassinated. Well, fucking AIDS, like, how many civic leaders in the gay community were assassinated by that, essentially? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, like, the government engineered AIDS like they did that.
Of course.
Although, no, I'm not even saying that. But you know, it's still, the effect is the same. If, like, you know, you take a certain number of, like, your up-and-coming leaders, the people that could be businessmen, that could be allies, and you just murder them without any rhyme or reason with this disease, then what the hell? So that's the thing that going through my mind is like, man, what would gay culture and how would gay acceptance be in America? Like, I feel like that set them back decades, because
yeah.
That zone meeting felt like something you'd see in the early 2000s, you know, like it felt very like that exact same, like, nah, this isn't, we're not going to let you do this. We're not going to let you stereotype and demean and all this other stuff. But that's interesting. I also think that's super interesting that Paul, like, his vision for what he wants as a gay man is this like super classy palace that everyone is like, like everyone's Oscar Wilde, and they're very funny and witty and smart, and they talk about politics. And then the place he goes when he, that fantasy or that trying to make that fantasy reality gets to be too much is like the opposite of what he wants. It's right. Like this rundown pier that's not even really, they're like essentially squatting, and it's just a bunch of anonymous sex, and it's grimy and filthy, and there's rats and drug use and all this other stuff. Like, there again, there's that dichotomy in his life. I also really feel for Ken, man, because it feels like Paul is really, I don't know how, like, if this marble urinals is for real, but like it does feel like Paul's kind of losing his mind. You know, he's not willing to compromise his vision at all.
Huh. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely something I admire about Paul's vision and
sure.
Paul's determination to accomplish the thing that he has crystallized in his head
yeah.
as that ideal place.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can definitely admire that. And I think, yes, there are places you can go with that dream and that vision that are overboard, certainly. And mm-hmm. I think marble urinals would qualify.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I don't think there are literally marble urinals. I think that Ken is worried that seeking the perfection he's trying to seek will get in the way of getting anything good at all.
Right.
And I very much understand that principle as well.
Right.
It's something that I struggle with myself, like
sure.
with my work and my personal life is just like, you know, that idea of letting perfection be letting perfect be the enemy of good enough.
Yep.
And so I see both sides of it, and I feel like there isn't an easy way out of that. It really, no. I just need to see which side of this battle is going to win. Is Ken going to be able to convince Paul that this is maybe not the best thing to try and chase
right.
this dream down to the detail? Maybe if they can get something done, it'll be good enough.
Yeah.
And I hope that's how it comes out. I hope Paul doesn't get so caught up in this dream that he loses his way and nothing comes of it.
Yeah, I also, what did you think of the scene? Because, like, Paul and Ken meet with that male porn actor that we saw earlier in the season, and now he's got this, like, little off-Broadway comedy show or, like, two-man show. I'm not sure exactly what the context of that was, but you're talking about him becoming a star. I was trying to think, like, you know, where are they going with this? Is like, because it seemed like Paul was like infatuated with this guy, and like Ken was a little bit of aware of it, and I wasn't sure if this was just like a, because I also was struck by how much he looks like just a buffer, younger, more famous and handsome version of Ken.
Okay.
You know, and he's got his shirt off, and he's got his pecs, and he's like, you know, and he's and I wonder
he's
if it's
trade
that,
up.
But also, it could be that like you're gonna like this is gonna be like this guy maybe could have been a breakout star, and he's gonna die of AIDS next season.
Yeah, could be.
I don't know because there's like this guy just keeps walking in and out and having a couple lines and like, okay, where is this going? It's either gonna be really really good or really really bad.
I mean, are they trying to show the types of clientele that Paul might have in his dream in his fantasy? Because
yeah,
this guy. I don't know that people who are doing these sort of off-Broadway, underground, homosexual plays are going to be able to afford the type of luxury that he's putting into his facility. So
that's interesting.
Is this something where we're tracking the trajectory of this star on the rise who's then going to be able to, you know, trade in the kind of circles that Paul is looking to attract? Or are we looking at the tragedy angle saying Paul does not have the clientele to support the dream that he's going after, and that Ken's ideal of compromising a little bit would actually fit the clientele better?
That's a really good take because now that I'm thinking about it, like it seems like the kind of guys that you want to show up there are like the politicians that want discretion, the businessmen,
the people with
like,
money.
And, yeah. then you get the beautiful people, like the actors
right.
and the talent in there too. Like, yeah, you're right. And it's also I think that like maybe it's something that Paul's realizing too, because like he had, you know, when he first appeared to the zoning committee, he had no idea that half of the people there were gay. Or
yeah.
At least two-fifths of the board were gay. So he's like, maybe I don't know. It's, I don't know. I think he's building the type of place he wants to go. But yeah, you're right. If it's so expensive that like could Paul from 5 years ago from season one right. of The Deuce afford to go to this club? And if not, like what the hell are you doing, Paul? You're pricing yourself out of the market.
It could be. Could be.
Do you want to talk about Bobby? Because Bobby's just another like you know he's a real sad sack character. But it's he's trying to fight wars on multiple fronts here. He's trying to gaslight his wife into like, you know, well, I'm not that involved. Well, I'm involved, but I'm protected. Well, I'm protected, but I still might spend a night in jail and humiliate you and your and our family. And also he's, you know, absolutely refusing to compromise with Vincent to keep the peace in Vincent's house about mm-hmm. you know, fuck you. Not only am I going to leave, I'm going to buy the whole bar around on me.
Let me say, I think Vincent's solution here of Bobby going away for a few days is not a solution at all.
Oh, it's horseshit.
This is kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
Abby is not happy with this man's presence on any level. And if he comes back at any time, she's going to have the same problem.
And she's wanting Vincent to make, choose a side, and Vincent trying to be like, you know, Vincent's trying to treat Abby like Frankie's treating his idiot girlfriend. Like, you know what, Bobby, just go away for a couple of days. I'll buy her some anchovy pizza, and she'll just be so thrilled that I remembered what her favorite time. And Abby's not that kind of girl. I don't even think Frankie's girl's that kind of girl. It's just like that works in any human relationship. That works a couple times. A person can say I'm sorry and do something nice, and you're like, okay, sure. You know where it goes from there is like whether the person stops doing the shit that is hurting you. I don't know. I think Bobby and his family life is fascinating, and I don't you think he's at risk of dying this season?
I don't think he's gonna die. I think what's more likely is his wife is gonna leave him. Or at least make steps in that direction.
Yeah. Let's see, what else do we have to talk about? I feel like, we didn't talk about the cops. So the morals task force is on uproar because the chief canceled the raids, which also pissed off Bobby and made Ralph Macchio's vice cop look like a fool, doubly this episode, because he said there's a raid coming and there wasn't. And then he said there's no raids coming and there was a raid coming. But Chris knows what he's doing. He's like, okay, if you're going to tell the media, don't tell them before an hour to keep it quiet. We're going to take people that we trust, which I thought was interesting that Ralph Macchio was in on that raid. I wonder how Chris, like when he told them that he just stayed in a room with him for a whole hour and, you know, Ralph Macchio was like, hey, I got to make a phone call. I got to tell Mr. Miyagi something. No, you sit your ass in here for the next hour. You're not leaving. You're not getting no phone calls.
No, I think it's literally that. Like, they call a meeting, they say, we're going to raid this place, and we're doing it right now. Get your gear.
Right.
But like, I just don't give an opportunity for a phone call. Don't let them out of your sight. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I get mixed feelings about, because I said there's something slightly chilling about these cops coming in with shotguns in what's essentially like a living room situation. Uh-huh. You know, it's like I like it when cops come in with guns drawn, when there's murders, when there's like an armed robbery, when there is like, you know, risk of massive loss of life or property damage or public safety concerns. It's always weird. And I understand that like sometimes you need to go into a Wall Street high rise and arrest a banker, and you probably need guns for that, too. But I mean, that's the thing. Like, if they were going to arrest like the executive of Merrill Lynch, they wouldn't fucking come in there with flashbangs and shotguns. They'd come in there with suits and handcuffs, right?
Sure.
And I just feel like the image of, it's just like, you know, like Frankie or Big Mike and Frankie coming in and fucking up that card game. It just felt like a violation of something. And I get it. There's human trafficking going on. There's underage girls working here. There is bad shit. But that, all of that bad shit is happening because this thing is illegal, not because it's intrinsic to the nature of the trade, you know? And I don't know. I think it's got to be intentional that this looked like this military precision raid, you're supposed to understand that we're living in 2018 where we see these things happening to serve people fucking warrants for over unpaid parking tickets and getting the wrong street and babies getting killed because a flashbang lands in their cribs and guys getting shot because they happen to live across the street from the right address from a guy who's going to get picked up for a outstanding marijuana violation. And like, this is how it all started. And how do we feel about that? And my answer is, I don't feel real good. It felt bad. Like what if somebody got an itchy trigger finger and like greased Bobby? Would that be justice?
You know? No, I feel you. It's a weird thing because at the same time, I'm torn. This is mob connected, right? There could be muscle in this place, and maybe they don't want. Maybe they're willing to kill a police officer or two.
But you keep going back. It's like, why are there guns? Why is there the mob? Are the cops? Why are the
Chicken and an egg. I totally feel you on that. It's just this is maybe a scenario where I'm okay with the raid when you know these things are mob connected. You know there's violence in the mob going on currently. There's potential for violence in this situation, and I think being prepared for that is a good thing. When you're serving warrants, fuck that. What do you need 16 police officers in SWAT gear and shotguns to serve a warrant?
Right. It all goes back to that. Like, you know, the reason, I mean, it's the cops have a dangerous job nowadays, but the problem is, I feel like it's the politician who has put them in harm's way. Cause it didn't used to be that every single traffic stop you'd come up to, you would expect to maybe get a gun pulled on you, because why the fuck would you? We've lived in a society where, Two and a half million people are in prison. There's that many order of magnitude that are felons, and they're on probation. Maybe they got a ticky tack parole violation that they're scared to get to thrown back in prison. So it's like you keep an up in the danger of just, you know, day to day interactions with the police, and you get this society that nobody wants. And it's, again, it's not the cops' fault. It's definitely the politicians, and fuck these people that in 2018 are still wanting to get doubled down on the drug war and like the other vice wars. We need to really hold those people accountable, because if we stopped all that right now, it's going to take decades for communities to return to the real gold standard of community policing.
Yeah.
But it's just going to get worse and worse until we stop it. Like, even if we stop it, it's going to take years to reverse the damage, and we're not even stopping. So,
right.
Yay. Hey, before we get into the a little bit of feedback we got, I just want to remind people that we have the club, theclub.baldmove.com. And if you are enjoying our coverage of the Deuce is a small show, and it's an even smaller podcast. And there's no way Jim and I would ever have dreamed of covering it if we were still working our full-time jobs. We'd be lucky to be doing one podcast a week. The reason we're able to do so many podcasts a week, all the ones we talk about in the housekeeping each week, is because we are supported by largely our listeners at club.baldmove.com. And it's not just an altruistic thing you do to support independent podcasters. You get a lot of really cool bonus features. If you like Jim and I and the things we do, I'm pretty sure you'll like Lunch with Jim and Aaron. You'll be interested in the behind the scenes look of the Empire business. You might find our quips funny. You might enjoy watching our podcast be live recorded, which often is the way to get the podcast hours before you might otherwise get them. Lots of cool features. You can check most of them out for free. Preview them just by going to club.baldmove.com. You can always get a 30-day free trial, risk-free, by signing up for the club. Club.baldmove.com. We don't have a ton of feedback. We did have a little bit from Warp Fox. He says, there's no way the big Mike caper doesn't come back to bite him in the ass. They're going to know that someone gave him a gun, and I doubt they're going to treat Mike's closet friend very nicely. Yeah, I wonder if they'll make that connection.
They might.
But yeah, I'm afraid for Mike. I'm afraid for Frankie, the not idiot Frankie. And I'm afraid for Big Mike's friend. How much of Frankie's movie producer act is Eileen going to put up with before she gets fed up with this bullshit?
0%. Yeah, none of it.
And what's Frankie's recourse if she just says, you know what? I've got your money. I've already spent it. You've got no muscle. You're a man without a country. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's got, I don't know, maybe, you know, like, I wonder, because Frankie reminds me a lot of that fucking big dick idiot in season 2 of The Wire, the dock worker's son. I forget what his name is.
The guy who was in the HBO sitcom.
Right. He keeps getting, like, that guy was an idiot, and he refused to realize it, and he refused to just play his role, and he ended up trying to do a caper, and he ended up, getting a bad end. And I wonder if Vincent's going to, like, because I could see Eileen doing that. Why wouldn't she? Like, yeah, you paid your 10 grand, you get your credit, mm-hmm. be on set, get your rocks off if you want, but stay the fuck out. And, like, Frankie getting indignant and, like, trying to tool up and cause trouble.
Yeah.
You know, like burn the place down or, like, rough up somebody. And then, you know, that's the problem, because Eileen doesn't have mob protection. Does that push? I don't know. I'm waiting to see how all these levers get worked.
Mm-hmm.
He also has a trivia note. The movie Larry's watching the theater's Blue Collar, starring Richard Pryor and Harvey Keitel. However, the actor featured in the monologue is Yaphet Kotto, a David Simon alum of sorts. He's best known for his portrayal of Lieutenant Giardello, or G, on the show Homicide: Life on the Streets, based on Simon's 1991 award-winning book of the same title. So that's cool. Hmm. I do like how he... I do know that this is loosely based on the real people that are, like, featured on The Deuce. I don't know whether those people are still alive, but a thing I thought was always amusing about The Wire is you would see, like, the real Avon Barksdale showing up as, like, a minister, a community outreach minister. Or you'd see the real Omar. You'd see the real Omar Little, like the guys based on, show up as like this old man who's a feat. I wonder if there are, because I know that Vincent and Frankie are based on a real person. I wonder if like some of these real life individuals have been around. I haven't heard anything, and I feel like that Seppenwall or like they would mention that on the behind the scenes thing. But I do like that he puts those little Easter eggs in for himself. So. Yeah. That is the show for The Deuce this week. I think we only got 3 left. We're really chewing through the season fast. If you'd like to send feedback, please do so at tv@baldmove.com. You can also get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, to talk about, the latest episode with your fellow fans. That's all we got to say. Until next week, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.